It's really important, and it can help us feel like we're accomplishing something when we can, in 10 or 12 minutes, actually read between a sixth and a seventh of the entire New Testament, so far as number of books are concerned. Read four books in that little amount of time. It's an amazing thing, and they made your point precisely well. The thing you were mentioning as a problem at the beginning of your remarks today is a troubling thing. Your generation and mine, we're never going to accept homosexuality no matter how long we live, but there's a new generation coming on that doesn't always have that same feeling. And I'm talking about in the church, don't always have that same view of things. And you're absolutely right. It does need to be addressed on a private level, private conversations, as well as public teaching, of course. But I think private conversations may accomplish more, perhaps. The issue of how do you love and yet speak truth is one that the New Testament deals with, and 2 John in particular, the one that Sam read, deals with that over and over and over again in just those few verses. So that was time well spent. Thank you for the wonderful meal today. I don't know how you do that over and over again. The variety was amazing, and I'm at a basket dinner almost every Sunday somewhere, but that was really a good one today. Thank you for that. This morning we were talking about 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 7, the properties of love. And I wanted to continue on with that a little ways this afternoon. The first one, and we talked about this morning, is that love is long-suffering. Love suffers long. And the second that goes right along with that, in fact, it's the sort of the other side of that, is that love is kind. The second attribute is that love is kind. Long-suffering endures the injuries of others, and then kindness repays them with good deeds. Long-suffering will take anything, and kindness will give anything. That's about the size of it. Kindness is like the other side of long-suffering. The root of this expression, kind, means useful. Love consciously uses itself on others. It's useful to other people. It does for others what they need to have done. It seeks the well-being even of those who try to harm it. And the context here in 1 Corinthians 13 is the church. Jesus said one time, in this world offenses will come, and that's certainly true, but offenses come in the church as well. Paul is not here picturing love in ideal surroundings. The Corinthian church was an atmosphere in which real love would really shine. It would stand out because it would be unusual there. The story is told of two men who met on a trail. One of them was coming from one direction and one was coming from the other direction, and they met. And this trail was only 1 foot wide. And there was a sheer rock wall on one side of the trail going up out of sight into the clouds, and there was a drop of several thousand feet on the other side of this 1 foot trail. So how are they going to get past each other? They tried every way they could think of, and nothing worked, until finally one of these men just laid down on the trail and the other one walked over him. And that worked just fine. And that's the way it works in the church. Love is the willingness to be walked on if it serves somebody. So it's not a battle about your rights and what you think you deserve. It's a battle to see how useful you can be to other people, even those who offend you. Kindness, usefulness, even in little things, maybe especially in little things, it makes a difference. And I could give you an illustration of this. I don't know if I should, because it takes a while to explain this illustration. I don't know. Should I? Yeah. There's a few of us here. Okay, you can decide later if you're glad you said to use it. It means something to me, but I don't know if it will to you. I have to explain it, or it definitely won't mean anything to anybody. But it's about me. I don't like that about it, but it's my life is the one I know the best. This is something that kind that was done for me recently within the last year. that really meant something to me, even though it might not seem like a big deal. I've got to explain, when I was a little boy, I was a big baseball fan, And our major league team here in Kansas City at the time was called the Athletics. I was a big fan of the Kansas City Athletics from early childhood on. I listened to their games on the radio. They weren't on TV, of course, and we didn't even have a TV in the very early days. But even though they were a lousy team, they seldom finished above eighth place in a 10-team league. I was all for them. Once in a while, my dad used to get tickets at his office, very rarely, just maybe two or three times in my whole childhood. But he would get tickets free at the office, and we would go down to the old municipal stadium at 22nd and Brooklyn and be there for the game. Usually those games didn't start till 8 o'clock, and there was no freeway, so it was hard to get home. So he would want to leave before the game was over, which I could just hardly tolerate, but he was dead, so I had to tolerate it. One time we were walking out of the stadium, and we heard a huge cheer going up after we'd gotten away from the field. And we ran back in, and our first baseman had just hit a home run, but there were no replays in those days, so we didn't get to see that. But anyway, I was a big A's fan. But when I got into high school, the A's left Kansas City for Oakland, California. It wasn't long before we got the Royals, and I became a fan of the Royals in the early years. But then I left Kansas City, and I didn't follow them very much for quite a while. Once in a while, we would go with a game just sort of to be sociable. I remember one time Dalen Ladina Landis wanted to go to the Royals home opener, and a bunch of us from the congregation here went to the Royals home opener. But I wasn't even a fan at that time. They had drawn a line out on the field so that they could apply the infield fly rule, and I didn't even know what that was because the rules had changed. Well, when the Royals won the World Series in 1985, I happened to be holding a meeting down at Summersville, Missouri, something that had been planned for years. Everybody else in the area, in the whole county, was a Cardinal fan. But after church, we would go over to either Clifton Cooper's house or Charlie Robinson's house, and we would watch whatever part of the game remained. Anyway, after the 1985 World Championship, the Royals seemed almost purposefully to dismantle their team. There was a baseball strike that I didn't agree with somewhere in there. And so I was a very fair weather fan. I was very busy, and I lost all interest. For decades, I lost all interest. Once in a while, we'd go with friends who had tickets and wanted us to go with them, but I wouldn't even know the name of even one of the players on the team. For decades. And I have to say, it's very liberating not to be a sports fan because you don't have to care. And when you're on the road a lot, you're in all kinds of situations in other people's houses, it's wonderful not to have to care about a baseball team. But there was always a latent and potential fandom beneath the surface of me. It was pretty easy to ignore it. And then the most unlikely thing happened in the most unlikely place. In August of 2014, I was over in Qatar in the Persian Gulf. And I was staying there with some friends in Doha, the capital city of Qatar, while I was working with a congregation that met in another private home. They had asked me to come over and do some teaching there. I went and met with that church for 10 days in a row, and it seemed like a very profitable period of time. Great experience. But one night before our meeting started, I was there with Matt Mikus sitting in the living room. Some of you know him. He's a member out at Lone Jack. Sitting in the living room of this place where the church was about to assemble. We were the first ones in the room that day. And as we were sitting there, way over on the other side of the world, surrounded on three sides by the Persian Gulf, Matt just happened to say to me, you know, the Royals are doing really well right now. And when he said that and started telling me the details of their recent victories and how they would come from behind and win, I could just feel the interest starting to stir within me. And that interest, long story short, on 2014, it crescendoed with the loss of the seventh game of the World Series in 2014. 2015 season arrived, and I told myself, I'm not going to care, I'm too busy, the season's too long. In April of 2015, I was staying over in Indiana with some people. There was a guy there also who was staying there who was from Kansas City. And he was talking about the Royals, but I didn't even allow myself to care in April of last year. By July, though, it looked like they were going to win their division, and I started to care in spite of myself. And by the end of the regular season, yes, I was into it with both feet. So here's what I wanted to tell you. The end of the regular season last year in 2015, the Royals, obviously won by a lot, they were going to be in the playoffs. But the first full week of October of last year, 2015, I was in Summersville again holding a meeting. These things are planned years ahead. You couldn't possibly predict when your team is going to be in the playoffs. I was staying with Bill and Aileen Fleener down in that general area there. This meeting had been scheduled for years, and that's Cardinal country, as I mentioned to you. So even if somebody can get the Cardinals on their TV, they might not be able to get the Royals, because that'll be a completely different thing. And I had just resigned myself. That fan that I wasn't going to be able to see that early part of the playoff games. And on the evening of the first playoff game, it hadn't started yet because we were going to church every night. But I was eating supper in the home of Brian and Janine Buttress before church. And I don't know if you know these people. It's a young family. They got some kids and a very, very busy lifestyle. Brian is a veterinarian. He not only has to have office hours, but they're in this farming area. And anytime somebody's animal, whatever their animal is, anytime it needs attention, day or night, he has to go, has to be on call. So very busy family, very busy life. But as we're talking just casually at this meal, he tells me that he not only gets the channel the game will be on. That was amazing enough, because these playoff games anymore, they're not just on TV. You've got to pay for these various channels, and I don't even know how all that works yet. But he tells me then that not only does he get the channel that this game is going to be on, but he can record the game, and that I can come over after church and I can start watching the game before the game's even over. I'd never even heard of that before. It may be old hat to you, but it wasn't to me at the time. So it was like an unexpected revelation to me. And that's what I mean, this type of thing, when I say love is kind, even in the little things. I went over there after church. I sat in their living room, which is right in the middle of their house. And understand, this is a young family. And they've got kids in school, and this week they've got church every night. So Brian hands me this clicker and shows me how to use it. And I'm sitting in the middle of their house while they're helping their kids with their homework, and they're helping their kids get ready for bed, and they're paying bills, they're answering phone calls, etc. And then they're getting ready for bed themselves. And I don't care what people say, I know that when you have an outsider in your house like that, it just disrupts everything. It changes everything. This old bald guy sitting on their couch clicking away. And eventually they all go to bed, and the Royals lose, and I let myself out the front door and go back to the Fleeners. The next afternoon is a day game, and they invite me back over there, and I watch the first part of that while their kids are coming home from school. And I just thought this was a remarkable act of kindness on their part. I really can't tell you how much it meant to me for the brethren to facilitate my addiction in this way. Love is kind. Love spends itself on other people. They didn't have to do that. They didn't even have to let me know that they had the capability of doing that. They could have kept mum about it. But they told me, and they seemed to genuinely welcome me into their home in that way. That is the kindness of Christian love expressed in something that might seem small, but to me, it was just kind of a big deal. So that was the illustration. Point number three, love is not envying. And this is the first of eight negatives in a row in this series. Love is not envying. And the word used here is sometimes translated as jealous. Other people use the word envy. There is a difference between jealousy and envy, but for purposes of this discussion, I'm not even going to go into that. Whatever it is, jealousy, envy, Solomon called it rottenness of the bones. And Shakespeare called it the green sickness. You've heard of green-eyed jealousy. It says, I want what he has, and even worse than that, deeper still, I wish he didn't have it. It's just plain meanness of the soul. And there's an analogy used in the previous chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 15. It's the analogy of the body as the church. If the foot says, because I'm not a hand, I'm not part of the body, is it for that reason really not a part of the body? If they were all one member, where would the body be? If every part of the body was a hand or a foot, where would the body be? It's easy to get out of balance. I met an ophthalmologist one time who told me that the purpose of the rest of the body was just to keep the eye from dragging the ground. He thought the eye was the most important part. Well, he was in the right profession. But all the parts of the body are important. All of them have a function to perform. And when love sees somebody who is gifted and effective and fruitful and popular and successful, love is glad of that. Jealousy hates the fact that the person is gifted and well-received. Jealousy wants what that person has and then wants that person not to have it. The root word here means to boil. People just boil up with jealousy. Jealousy burns in the heart and it leads to carping criticism. Nothing's ever quite right about that person. The jealous person has to tear down the fruitful and faithful person. This morning, Brian read the first portion of the first chapter of the Philippian letter. And in that writing there, Paul, writing from prison, tells about some guys in the church who were jealous of him. They're preaching Christ from jealousy and strife. They proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition rather than from pure motives. And they want to cause me more distress, says Paul. But Paul says, as long as they're preaching the truth, whether in pretense or in sincerity, as long as Christ is preached correctly, I rejoice and I will rejoice, because the message is the main thing. Love rejoices in their usefulness. But Paul says to the Corinthians in chapter 3, verse 3, you are carnal, and that's why there's envy among you. Jealousy is such a destructive thing. If you started at the beginning of the Bible and charted the sins connected to jealousy and envy, it would really be a long list. From the very beginning, out of jealousy, Eve ate the fruit, wanting to be like God. Out of jealousy, Cain killed Abel. Out of jealousy, Joseph was sold into slavery by his brothers. Out of jealousy, the older brother wouldn't go to the party when the prodigal came home. Proverbs 27, verse 4. Who is able to stand before envy? Envy is hatred without a cure. Envy destroys the insides of a person. It wouldn't destroy the Apostle Paul, but it will destroy the jealous lesser man. It's a root of bitterness that is destructively corrosive over time. So James says in James 3:14, if you have bitter envying and strife in your heart, glory not. This kind of stuff is a wisdom that does not descend from above, but that is earthly, sensual, and devilish. And he says in verse 16, where you have envy and strife, you have confusion and every evil work, and chaos will reign. The only thing that can conquer envy and jealousy and the party spirit is love. A loving person rejoices in everybody else's success and celebrates when others do the same thing he does better. Illustration. King Saul had a son named Jonathan. Jonathan may have been next in line for the throne. And then along came a singer by the name of David. David was not only a singer, but a lion tamer and a giant killer. David was handsome, articulate, poetic, musical, had talent running out of every pore. And Saul hated him. David was a threat. When Saul would hear, oh, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000s, Saul grabbed his spear and tried to run him through. We don't know much about Jonathan. We know he could shoot an arrow fairly well, but that's about it. We don't know anything about his musical ability, but we know that he wasn't jealous of David. Jonathan had perhaps as much or more to lose as Saul. The throne might have been Jonathan's under other circumstances. But we read in 1 Samuel 20, verse 17, that Jonathan loved David as he loved his own soul. And that was the difference between Saul and Jonathan. Saul was jealous and Jonathan loved. Love is not jealous. Love does not envy. The thing that saves you from jealousy and envy is love. A loving person rejoices in the excellence and in the success of others. The fourth thing, love is not boastful. Love does not brag. The King James Bible said, love vaunteth not itself. Love does not verbalize pride, because love does not have pride. The word here means a windbag, a blowhard, and it's used only here in the whole New Testament. It's the person who elevates himself and denigrates other people. The person who calculates everything to make himself look good and you look bad. There's no love in that. Love is not a windbag. Love is not always shooting off its mouth about its own accomplishments. Envy wants what you have. Boasting is calculated to cause others to want what it has. The boastful person can see only himself. He can't see beyond himself. And that's self-centeredness. And the Corinthians were a bunch of spiritual show-offs vying for attention. But if you love, it'll get you away from always talking about yourself and flaunting yourself. Number five, love is not puffed up. And this will be the last one we'll talk about today. Love is not puffed up. Love is not arrogant. The original word is an onomatopoeia. You know, an onomatopoeia, that's a word that sounds like the thing it's describing, like the buzz of a bee. That's an onomatopoeia. This word in the original language is phusio. Phusio means to puff up like a bellow. We had Arlen Bingham here this morning. His father was a blacksmith. I used to go in that blacksmith shop down in Bogard, Missouri, and had those big bellows there to fan the flames of the fire. Quite a thing to see and quite a thing to experience. Phusio means to puff up like a bellow. And that's this idea of being puffed up, arrogant on the inside. Illustration. Pietro Mascagni was a composer and a conductor of music in Italy. He wrote an opera called The Masks. And here is the dedication he gave to his opera. Quote, "To myself, with distinguished esteem and unalterable satisfaction," end quote. The story goes that one time Mascagni was invited to conduct portions of a Verdi opera at a musical festival in Milan, Italy. And he was invited to conduct with another more famous and more accomplished conductor in Italy whose name was Toscanini. A lot of people have heard of Toscanini. Mascagni resented Toscanini because Toscanini was Toscanini and was more accomplished. So when Mascagni met with the people who were providing him this opportunity to conduct with Toscanini, he said, "I will do this under one condition. You pay me more than you pay Toscanini." Well, the people were a little taken aback by that, but they agreed to it, and he signed the contract. Then after the concert was over, they gave him 1 lira, because Toscanini conducted for nothing. And Mascagni was humiliated and looked like an idiot after he made this point about this contract. Proverbs 11, verse 2 says, "When pride comes, then comes shame." We can mark it down. That's the way it works out sooner or later. Proverbs 16, 18, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." Proverbs 29, 13, "A man's pride shall bring him low." What a commentary on the misery of a loveless soul that he had nobody to dedicate this opera to except himself. How lonely is that world? If you want to isolate yourself, just convince yourself that you're better than everybody else. And this goes deeper than just the mouth. This is the disease of conceit. But love is not puffed up. The Corinthians were puffed up, and Paul says so in several places. You're puffed up. You think I won't come to you and read you the riot act. You're puffed up about your knowledge. You're puffed up about your spiritual state. Paul says, what do you have that you didn't receive? You have nothing to boast about. "You have reigned as kings without us. Aren't you something, you Corinthians? You think more highly of yourselves than you ought to think. And you are in gross carnality. There's sexual sin among you that's not even so much as named among the Gentiles. And you're puffed up?" Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Conceit wants everybody to know all the wonderful things about it. It's a sounding brass. Empty trucks make the most noise. But love is not big-headed. Love is big-hearted. John the Baptist pointed over at Jesus and said, "He must increase, I must decrease." Humble people can love. Arrogant people have a hard time loving. Love was the only hope for the Corinthians, and it's our only hope too. Love is the only power in the world that can save us from the stupid swagger of competitive arrogance. Somebody blown up on the inside, going to be a windbag on the outside. Those two go together. Well, we didn't talk about all of these, but that gives a little flavor of what he's talking about here. Sometime if you want to, maybe we'll fill out some of the rest of these here, because they're very interesting to examine them, just like they're petals on one flower. And when they all are together, it's a beautiful portrait of love. We're going to conclude at this time by once again extending the invitation. If you're subject to the gospel call in any way, we really do want you to take advantage of this opportunity to let us know what's on your mind, and we'll help you as much as we possibly can. Please come as we stand and sing the invitation number.